This is an interview for the SEC Historical Society's online virtual archive on the history of financial regulation. Today is April 12, 2011. I'm James Stoker. I'm talking today with Jim Leisenring. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
We're talking today at the FASB offices in Norwalk, Connecticut. So I figured we'd start at the beginning. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Battle Creek, Michigan, and lived there virtually all my life, except for 3 years during the war and World War II. And went to school, you know, in the vicinity as well by going on to Albion College.
Mm-hmm. Where were you during the war?
Detroit.
Okay. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. How did you come to attend Albion College?
I really don't remember. I applied two or three places, and I think the recollection was that that's the best school that I got into. And like a lot of people at that, I picked the best school that admitted me.
Did you study economics or accounting?
Economics. Albion College had no accounting major when I was there. I think I took 9 hours of accounting.
Did you have any particular influences while you were there, professors that you remember?
An accounting professor that certainly influenced me because I took the last 3 hours of accounting from him, Maynard Harris, and certainly he encouraged me to study more accounting at some point in time. So, yes, I was influenced by Maynard Harris. But I was more of an economics political science major, so there were other professors at Albion that influenced me perhaps as much as Maynard in other areas, particularly Charlie Hardy in the political science department.
Okay. After you graduated in 1962, you did an MBA at Western Michigan University. Why did you decide to do an MBA?
Decided to do an MBA for a variety of reasons. I always knew I was either going to go get an MBA or go to law school. I decided against law school for a variety of reasons in my senior year. Just got more interested in economics and accounting, and finance. And frankly, went to Western Michigan because they offered me, at the time, significant amount of money to go there to work on an MBA and get a research fellowship.
That sounds like a good reason. Then afterwards, you decided to stay there as an instructor.
Yes. In fact, what got me interested in accounting, because I wasn't really interested in accounting, and in those days you took an MBA with a concentration, and my concentration was in finance. And I had to take a couple of undergraduate classes at Western with no credit to meet the prerequisites to take the finance courses that I needed for the MBA. And in the process of taking those accounting courses, obviously became acquainted with a couple of the accounting professors, and that got me more interested in accounting. And there was some unfortunate health problems with one of the professors there, and they asked me to step in and teach accounting, mm-hmm. which I did by staying, you know, two pages ahead of the students at all times. But it really causes you to learn something to have to teach it, and I became much more interested in accounting by teaching elementary accounting.
How do you think teaching accounting shaped your later career as an accounting standard setter?
Well, I think I don't know that teaching it in the early days shaped my career at all, but in the later days of teaching, I was teaching accounting theory and theory and problems classes, the capstone accounting classes, and I certainly led me to appreciate that you ought to have an underlying basis for the conclusions that you're reaching about accounting issues, and that there ought to be some consistency to those conclusions, which I think has been something that I obviously have believed in all through the standard setting period of my life.
Why did you decide to leave academia and enter practice?
Money. The Western Michigan was perfectly willing to tolerate me as an MBA CPA on the faculty, but those years way back then, that isn't the right way to pursue an academic career, and I was unwilling to take the time to go get a PhD, mm-hmm. and so I left and went into public accounting.
What was your first job in the accounting profession?
First job in the accounting profession, because I'd been teaching 4 years, I went with a firm as a manager mm-hmm. in their technical area.
What firm was that?
Dorn Mayhew in Detroit.
Okay. And how did you come to form the firm of Bristol Reisenring Herkner and Company?
Bristol Reisenring Herkner is a split-up of Doran Mayhew. Doran Mayhew was a Detroit-based firm, and they had offices out of Detroit, out what we call outstate offices, Battle Creek, Kalamazoo, other places. And the firms, like frequently happen, amiably decided that it was better to part company. Mm-hmm. And Bristol Reisenring Herkner became the outstate offices of what was Doran Mayhew.
What kind of clients did you work on?
Private companies, almost exclusively. Did some, a little bit of SEC work, but almost none. We had very heavily skewed audit practice for a small firm, and had some rather large clients for a small firm, but they were private companies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how did you move from private practice to the FASB?
I moved from private practice to the FASB in a couple of steps, and that's my firm was very supportive of me being involved in professional activities, and a big part of our client base was in the construction industry, and I was asked by the AICPA to be on a task force that wrote the Construction Contractors Audit Guide and SOP 811, and in doing so, had a lot of contact with the AICPA staff, who in turn asked me to go on what was then the Auditing Standards Executive Committee. And while I was on that, it changed its name to the Auditing Standards Board. And then after 2 years of service on there, they asked me to chair the Auditing Standards Board for 3 years.
Why did the board change its name?
I don't remember why they changed their name.
It was just a name change. It didn't change its duties at all?
It didn't change anything to my recollection, no. But the Auditing Standards Board became the new name, and I became the chairman. And in that period, was some of the S&L issues, there was some amount of congressional testimony with respect to the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act, or things that led to the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act, I guess, and gave me a visibility as the Auditing Standards Board chairman that put me in touch with the then chairman of the FASB, Don Kirk. And the Chairman Kirk sent me a letter just as I was leaving the Auditing Standards Board, my term was up, saying that they needed to replace the Director of Research and Technical Activities at the FASB because he was leaving to go on to other things, and asked for suggestions as to who might take that job. He said he'd sent that letter to about, I think he said, 20, 25 people. I sent him dutifully my three suggestions as he requested, and he called me back in a couple weeks and said my name was on an enormous number of the letters, and would I consider the job? And I told him unequivocally no, I wasn't interested, but if you've never met Mr. Kirk, you would know he's a very persuasive person, and eventually I went to the FASB as Director of Research and Technical Activities.
Why were you hesitant to take the position?
I actually am one of those rare ones, I guess. I love public accounting. I love practicing accounting, and Auditing Standards Board had occupied an enormous amount of my time, so that I wasn't practicing as much as I would have enjoyed, and I look forward to going back to it. Mm-hmm. And just didn't dawn on me that I wanted to moved to Connecticut. Didn't dawn on me that my family would want to be disrupted, as I had a daughter in junior high and a daughter in high school. And so it just, my initial reaction was no.
So when you took the position, did you expect to spend the rest of your career in accounting standards setting?
Absolutely not. I actually made a commitment to Don Kirk that I would stay for the rest of his term, which is, I think, at the time about 3.5 to 4 years. And I fully intended at that point in time to go back to public accounting.
Tell me about the job of the FASB research director. What sort of projects did you work on?
Well, at that time, there were three classes of activities within the technical agenda, what's so-called major projects, which were going on, which involved, at the time, the biggest one was pensions. But then we had what we called implementation and practice problems, and those were the asset clearance type of issues. They were much more narrowly focused. They were an attempt to extract some of the AICPA literature and incorporate it into the FASB literature, that activity. And then the third class was the conceptual framework, And at that point in time, I think we spent about 25% to a third of our time on conceptual framework. So I had an early indoctrination on the necessity of reaching some conclusions around conceptual issues.
Tell me about the conceptual framework. What was the point of coming up with a conceptual framework?
Well, I think historically the board realized from its inception that it needed one, and indeed one of the criticisms of the APB, the predecessor of the FASB, is it did not have a conceptual foundation for the conclusions. They were accused of ad hoc decisions to issues that should be answered consistently.
Mm-hmm. What sort of research does one do in order to come up with a conceptual framework?
Well, the research that was done, whether that's what one should have done, is probably debatable, but is to identify what seemed to be the impediments to reaching consistent conclusions on standard issues. And the FASB's initial agenda had on it accounting for contingencies, and it also had research and development costs. And the board quickly learned that they did not have an effective definition of an asset to determine what to do with research and development costs, and they did not have an effective definition of a liability to deal with the issues of accounting for contingencies. So it became obvious to the initial board that at least asset liability definitions were going to be significant, as well as, of course, once you decide they are an asset or a liability, you have to decide whether or not to recognize them and how to measure them. So I think it became fairly obvious that the accounting process is about recording elements on financial statements, and to do that you have to measure them. And the early focus, after we agreed on the objective of financial reporting and the qualitative characteristics of information to make it decision useful, which took a fair amount of time, a couple, 3 years, my recollection, for statements 1 and 2, we got immediately into what has become concept statement 5 and 6, recognition and measurement and the elements definitions, which, by the way, is still controversial and still on the board's agenda at the moment.
Were accounting firms as interested in participating in the process that led to these conceptual statements as they were in the standards themselves, or do they see them as something abstract and more removed?
I think the firms were in better position to answer that, but my perception of them would be that they were very encouraging to do it, to do the work on the framework, but they were not as directly involved and didn't feel the need to be as directly involved as the board seemed to be. But that wasn't that they discouraged the effort in any way. In fact, they encouraged it. But I think day-to-day activities inevitably made them more interested in standard-setting issues than the conceptual framework.
Let's talk a little bit about the relationship between the board members and the staff. How did the staff transmit their research to the board members?
And I don't know when this became the mode of operation at the FASB, but when I arrived here, and that's probably the leadership of Kirk and the rest of the board, the staff was thought to be very independent. They were told to reach their own conclusions on issues. They were told to, in fact, do their best to convince the board of what they thought were the optimal conclusions. My approach was to suggest and to emphasize to the staff that they had an incredible luxury, if they're interested in accounting standards and accounting theory, to be assigned a person, for example, working on foreign currency or the person working on pensions, that they will probably know more about the subject matter than anyone in the world, and in fact ought to know more about it, that it's their obligation to make sure they did know more about it and to reach conclusions that they thought were the optimal answers, present them to the board, and essentially they became educators because the board did not know as much about each of those subjects in detail because the board had a dozen things on the agenda. And that was a method that we used and I believe continues essentially to this day, although the nature of the agenda has changed a bit. But I still think the staff is very much an independent staff at the FASB that is told to make sure the board is aware of the issues they become aware of.
So the board members are probably working on many different issues at any one given point in time. Do the staff members prepare briefing papers, or do they give presentations to the entire board?
They do prepare briefing papers, but those are all done in public meetings. Mm-hmm. The decision-making of the board is in pre-announced public meetings with agenda papers that the staff has prepared with staff recommendations. Mm-hmm.
I understand that there's a rule of procedure that prevents so-called educational presentations to any more than three board members at once. Is there a rule?
Well, educational presentations are just open to the public. That's the easiest way to solve that problem.
Right.
And yes, and we're not. We don't have private meetings on technical matters.
Okay. Do you think that would be a problem if you had private presentations by staff members to board members?
Well, they can talk one-on-one, but with the thought being, historically, that you can't have a quorum. They can't have a sufficient number of board members that could issue a standard. When we had five board members, that would have been three. When you have seven, that would be four. That you shouldn't be able to go offline, so to speak, and reach your conclusion and come into a public meeting and rubber stamp it. And I think people have to appreciate that, you know, open meetings, public meetings, are not there so that people know the answer, because obviously you can print minutes an hour after the meeting and people would know the answer. It's there to, so the public has a public interest in the performance of the board. They can assess the quality of the deliberations. They can assess individual board members' contributions or lack thereof to the deliberations. And that's all part of having a public responsibility.
One of the things that happened while you were research director was a reorganization of the Industry Fellows Program. Do you remember much about that?
The Industry Fellows Program wasn't reorganized while I was research director, to my recollection. Uh-huh. Not at all. No, they were there when they were in present when I came, and they're still here.
I asked that because I read a newspaper article
from the early 80s. I think the article is not correct.
It's probably, you know, not correct, and maybe that's specific.
Or it was earlier 80s than when I was here that happened, but the fellow program was around and didn't change while I was research director.
Yeah. Well, what the article said was that the program had been in existence since 1977, but that no fellows from the accounting profession had actually come to work at the FASB during this period until the early 1980s, because they had trouble recruiting people from the accounting firms.
Well, they may have had trouble recruiting people in the early years. I wasn't here and wasn't aware of that. Mm-hmm. But when I came here, there were fellows on board from the firms.
Okay. How important was their work in communicating with the firms and
their principal responsibility is to be like any other staff member, except that because their tenure's going to be for 2 years, they were the ones that were the principal project managers and staff on implementation and practice problems, and not on projects, for example, that were predictably going to last 4 or 5 or 6 years, and they were not particularly involved with the framework. The so-called permanent staff did the major projects in the framework, and they did the IPP. And, of course, in my tenure, 1984, the fellows became far more critical to the success of the Emerging Issues Task Force. The formation of the Emerging Issues Task Force sort of gave credibility to the work that the practice fellows had been doing right along, and they were the staff of the Emerging Issues Task Force. I was the chairman, but they were the staff.
Okay, that's very interesting. Well, let's definitely talk about that just a little bit later. Just to talk a little bit more about the job of the research director. In recruiting staff, did the FASB have a high turnover rate at this point? Did you have any trouble keeping staff? Or were people interested in going back into the private sector?
Well, some people were. It varied. We actually had a model that we've sort of embraced, that I inherited when I became research director, that probably about 5 years is long enough to be here, 5 or 6 years. But that got stretched out a little bit as the project started to take a little bit longer, and there was always sort of a conscious debate and decision as to if you were a project manager that finished a major project, for example, are you going to start another one? And probably then have your tenure be 10 or 11 years, or was it time to move on? And you typically, staff and board, I think, or staff and research director and board reached a mutual conclusion with most of them that the useful model was to do the major project, stay on for a year or so to make sure no implementation questions or difficulties arose, and then move on. Now, that didn't happen for everybody, and there were people that stayed here for much longer than that period of time, but they're the exception, not the rule.
Was it possible to move up the ranks? Was it easy?
Well, there weren't many ranks to move up. At past project manager, we had a couple of other positions, senior technical advisors, and those people were not moving, and we didn't want them to. So it was really stay a project manager or move on. And again, a lot of people would said, well, I don't want to do another project, another five-year project. Some said, yes, I do. And there were a couple that did that. It wasn't the model.
As research director, did you have any contact with the trustees?
Very limited. Very limited amount. I reported to the board. Mm-hmm. So my trustee involvement was as they requested it.
But they didn't offer any input into your work or anything?
No, like not directly. No, sir.
Okay. What about with Congress or the SEC?
A lot of involvement as research director with the SEC, and particularly, again, once the EITF was going on, the SEC was very interested in EITF issues. Mm-hmm. And so the staff and research director's involvement with the SEC was significant and was from day one for me as research director, even before the EITF. Congress... not so much, although I did do a little bit of, I had a few activities with Congress as research director, but most of the activities I've ever had with Congress came later as a board member.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the EITF now. How did this come about? How was it produced?
The EITF was really instigated by the trustees. The trustees... did have senior partners, managing partners of some of the major firms. They weren't all eight on at any one time. I can't remember now. I think maybe three at a time. But it was a period of time where there was a lot of accusation that people were opinion shopping, which translates to mean they were looking for answers to technical issues and that there were pressures on auditing firms to change answers in response to what perhaps one firm was willing to do. So it was thought to be a race to a sort of a lowest common denominator. That might be unfair. It may actually have been a race to the right answer, but at least the perception was that that's not the case, and that they thought that it was undermining the respect for the profession, the types of things that were going on, or at least said to be going on, and the trustees asked that the FASB give more timely guidance, was the buzzword at the time, so that these issues didn't linger and that there was a point to have them resolved. And the trustees asked that we explore how to be more involved with that timely guidance. A task force was formed that was chaired by a man whose name I don't remember, but we can look up, from Shell Oil, that wrote a report that recommended essentially the structure of the EITF. One of the things that I thought was important about it is it brought the EITF into the public arena because all meetings were open to the public. The issues were talked about in the public. And I think particularly for firms other than the largest six or eight, over the years, it gave them an avenue to really understand the issues that were of concern, and there wasn't any risk that eight firms could go in a room and resolve an issue between themselves, which, by the way, the antitrust people said was not defensible, and another reason to have the meetings be in public through the FASB. And
that's interesting because that's basically what the APB had been.
Yes.
12 years before.
That's right. Yeah. But not thought to be acceptable.
Right.
And it needed a different forum. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a good many of the issues historically, early on, the issues were lingering ones that had been troublesome to the profession for the previous few years. And there was sort of an early rush to address some of those issues. But after that, frequently the issues were ones where a registrant firm and the SEC were in conflict with one another, all right, and that a good many of the issues were those where the SEC did not agree with a firm or did not agree with a registrant, and the SEC would say, well, you know, we're willing to debate the issue, bring the issue to the EITF. So a fair number of later on, after, say, the first couple of years, they were issues that a firm or a registrant would ask the staff here to see, to put on the agenda, and there was an agenda committee forum that actually vetted those issues and decided which ones needed resolution.
So there's almost a forum for arbitration between when there's a...
It wasn't really arbitration because it wasn't a matter of negotiation. That's it true. Was still a matter of decision-making, but at least the context for the decision and who was to make it, with the SEC saying once an EITF issue is resolved, it will be followed, gave them an authoritative status that I think met the objective the trustees initially had of giving timely guidance. Now, I understand some people think that it got out of hand and issued too much guidance. That's a group of people who would prefer less resolution to the specific issues. I understand that. That's an argument that one can have a different opinion about. I accept.
I read that in the first year of its existence, the EITF met 11 times and dealt with 65 issues, so it certainly was working on a lot of different subjects.
Early on, but in all honesty, some of those issues are pretty easy compared to some of them later on. The issues got much more difficult two or three or four years into the history of the EITF than they were in the easy years, or the early years, not easy early. Mistake.
The good old days, I guess. Tell me about the difference between EITF rulings and FASB standards.
Well, there's a gap hierarchy in the United States that starts with FASB standards and moves down the hierarchy. As a practical matter, there isn't much difference. They're not supposed to be inconsistent with an FASB standard. That would make the gap hierarchy very important, but less important when they're not inconsistent, if they are just interpretive, and they are consistent with the standards. And now, in recent years, the FASB clears EITF issues. People have made a big deal about that, and it does make it more obvious that the FASB is clearing and debating and involved with the issues. But as a practical matter, from day one, board members took an interest in the issues, and if they actually thought and the conclusion of the EITF was incompatible with U.S. GAAP, they would not have settled for that.
Do you remember any instance when that happened?
No. But I do remember instances where we had debates about whether it was consistent or not, and ended up being satisfied that the answer was appropriate.
You care to talk about any of those? Or?
I just don't remember which ones they are. That's you know, many, many years ago now.
It was many years ago. Do any issues that the EITF dealt with still stick out in your mind?
No, not really. They've all kind of blurred together. They're probably a combination of my age and the length of time since I dealt with them. But
You've done a nice job of attributing credit to the EITF to the trustees. But some people have said that you were very much involved in the creation of the board itself and the structuring.
Well, it was my assignment to do that.
Right.
The chairman of the FASB at the time said, okay, we've decided to do this to, quote, Bob Herz, make it happen, you know, was sort of what the orders were. Right. And frankly, there were practice fellows. Keith Wishon from Price Waterhouse was the person that was the number one staff person in the formative year. And Keith deserves as much credit as I deserve for what happened in that first year, as does J.T. Ball. J.T. Ball was the assistant director at the FASB, handling implementation and practice problems. So he and Keith and I work very closely together. Certainly Keith and JT have just as much right to be feel good about the accomplishments of the EITF as I do.
Some people have argued that the EITF was more of a forum for the accounting firms to advance the interests of their clients than a group that was actually interested in finding professional solutions to the problems. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
I don't think it's fair completely, no. I think there are certainly instances where that may have been the case, particularly, as I said, when the registrant in the firm disagree with the SEC and they brought it to the EITF, you wouldn't really have expected the registrant and or the firm that had reached a conclusion with its client to not advocate their answer. Now, if that means they're trying to push the interests of their client, I think they might be pushing their mutual interest, but I don't think that that universally happened. It's just far, far too often that the firm said, this has not been our position, but we understand this alternative and we'll accept it and move on. So episodically, that could very well be true, but I don't think universally it's fair. I think the firms behave far better than that.
So in 1987, you were appointed as a board member. Is it typical for a staff member, even a high-level one, to go on to become a board member?
Well, it wasn't then, but it has become more so now because two other board members here are former staff people. Mm-hmm. Larry Smith and Leslie Seidman both had a very similar job at the FASB. And while Larry just moved from directing and being chair of the EITF to a board member, Leslie Seidman was the director of the IPP area and then was gone for a few years and came back as a board member. So there are three of us now that have done that.
Why was it not typical before?
I think it's more than anything else is just timing. And
you don't think that there was maybe a disinclination to hire staff members or maybe some desire to see a separation between the staff and the board?
No, I don't think so. I think it would be a combination of the timing of things. Board membership seats have had a historical pattern of those from industry, those from public accounting, those from academia, from the user community. And I'm not sure if I went back and looked, perhaps just the timing wouldn't have worked out right for someone to do that. Quite honestly, I think the research director's job that I had and then Tim Lucas had, and it was the best, it was certainly the best job I've ever had, most enjoyable job I've ever had. I've many times have regretted not keeping it and going on to the FASB, but marginally so. It just was very, very interesting.
Were you surprised to be offered a seat on the board?
No, I wasn't surprised because for a particular reason. I wasn't surprised because when Don Kirk retired, or his terms were completed as chairman, I was a seriously considered candidate to be chairman of the FASB. So was an existing board member at the time, Arthur Wyatt from Arthur Anderson. Art and I were candidates, interviewed for the chairmanship, and my personal opinion at the time of the interview was that Art was far better qualified than I, for no other reason. He was several years older, and that, you know, I was perfectly content to be research director if he was chairman. Now, he didn't end up becoming chairman. Denny Beresford did. But I stayed on, as Denny asked me to, when he was appointed, too. So I think it was sort of a notion that I needed more time, but, it didn't take very long to come about that they had an opening on the board because Art Wyatt resigned as a board member, and I replaced Art on the board. And so it wasn't a surprise that I was a candidate because they initially asked me, and again, maybe I just don't accept change when thrown at me very well, because when they initially asked me, am I interested in Art seat, I said, no, I was content where I was. But then trustees, and Dwayne Kohlberg, who was the chairman of Arthur Anderson, did a pretty good job of talking me into going on the board.
Were you giving any thought at that time to going back to private practice?
I was given some thought about it.
Understandably.
Nothing else. My age was such that if I was going to make a move back to private practice, I was going to have to do it. Mm-hmm. And I did think about it, but those thoughts didn't ever go very far.
Mm-hmm. So how did the experience of being a board member compare to what you expected before? Were there any surprises about what?
No.
I mean, you probably knew the position pretty well after having been at the FASB for so long.
Yeah, I didn't know. The board member job was as I suspected it would be.
As much fun.
And as much or as little fun as I expected it would be. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I was not surprised, unlike I think some board members have been appointed and significantly surprised mm-hmm. by the job, and that's understandable, I think, but yeah. I was not.
What were some of the most important issues that were going on at that time when you joined the board? Do you remember?
Well, we were liabilities and equity, mm-hmm. and we were beginning, and the involvement with stock options, liabilities and equity, other post-employment benefits other than pensions. So those were the big issues that continued on, and it was clearly soon obvious, in fact already was obvious, that what would become the issue that is still the issue, financial instruments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was obvious to everyone here that financial instruments was the 800-pound gorilla in the room. That
so you knew it was going to be a very sensitive
absolutely,
issue.
Absolutely,
absolutely. Yeah. But already in 1991, the FASB was able to issue a standard on financial instruments.
Yeah, but not comprehensively enough to deal with all of the issues that needed to be dealt with.
Did you expect?
And because that's because we parsed it up.
Right.
We knew that it was a huge issue, but we had impairment of financial instruments. We had classification and measurement of security, marketable securities and the like. We had derivatives as an other issue. We had not just accounting for derivatives, but hedging. We still had not resolved liabilities and equity and the structuring opportunities that exist around really cumbersome literature for the distinction, which still exists in many respects. So, no, we issued several standards, but some would argue to this day still have not resolved it because we have inconsistencies, and the complexity of the path we took is overwhelming.
Is the major problem the complexity of the issue as a research issue, or is it simply politically difficult to pass?
Well, it's both. I mean, it's politically difficult to pass some things, and we certainly had our political problems with aspects of financial instruments, but that isn't as difficult as people just not wanting an answer that would resolve, in many respects, much of the complexity. I think that an enormous amount of the complexity has to do with measuring things differently and setting the boundaries for when something is in bucket A versus bucket B versus bucket C and the way it's measured. And those bright lines bring about a lot of complexity. The way to remove that complexity, instigating perhaps a different complexity, would be to measure everything at fair value rather than measure some things at fair value and the line between when they are and aren't. Mm-hmm. People seem to like that complexity because they certainly don't want to measure everything at fair value. And that becomes one of the political reactions, is the objection to full fair value for financial instruments.
And then people claim that that fair value with things like derivatives becomes a little bit difficult to determine.
It's difficult to determine, but we have no ambiguity that derivatives are fair value. Mm-hmm. So that in some respects, there's a disingenuity about some of the arguments because the more difficult financial instruments are fair value. Some of the more easily measured ones are not. So that isn't purely a complexity over the estimation of fair value. There's something else going on in those arguments other than complexity.
So you mentioned stock options a little bit earlier. Did you expect that stock options would be as controversial an issue as it turned out to be?
No, I would not have estimated that. But that's a naivete, to be sure. Particularly since at the time we proposed putting stock option accounting on the agenda, 7 of the 8 Big 8 firms encouraged us to do that. And the resolution needed because people were getting more and more adventuresome about accounting for stock options. And people misstate the issue in the sense that they say stock options were not accounted for. That's not so. Certain stock options were measured so-called variable option plans were accounted for. Fixed plans were accounted for at intrinsic value, and as long as you issued a fixed plan with that was not in the money, there was no accounting for that, and there was no subsequent measurement of it. It's not particularly anomalous that an equity instrument's not subsequently measured, and if you believe a fixed option plan is an equity instrument of the entity, and certainly is what the definitions would say, we don't remeasure common stock of the entity either, or preferred stock or other equity instruments. So there wasn't anything anomalous about that. It was that on day one you were ignoring that just because it wasn't in or out of the money that it didn't have value that was arguably, certainly, in the board's view, compensation expense. And that compensation expense was what was ignored for with respect to fixed plans, not variable. Mm-hmm. And no, I would not have. People, of course, wanted to make plans very variable but get them accounted for as fixed. And that was some of the issues that prompted it getting on the agenda. But I would have never dreamed that it was going to become the issue as vitriolic as it became.
So in 1993, the FASB finally issued its exposure draft on the issue of stock options that proposed to require the valuing of options at fair market value on the day they were granted.
That's not exactly, true.
Okay.
They did have them measured on the date of grant. It wasn't exactly fair value. It's fair value related.
Okay.
But yes, you're essentially correct.
Okay. For a non-accountant, that's as close
for
as
a non-accountant, you did fine.
Thank you. Was the board united on this exposure draft?
Exposure draft, yes.
Okay. And once the draft was issued, obviously the backlash began.
Yes.
And at this point, the FASB seems to have had to do quite a bit of public outreach to try to sell its proposal to the public.
Well, there was a significant amount of contact with all over the country. And obviously there were sections of the country that were employers extensively used stock options that were more opposed to the proposal than others. But it became, in my opinion, a different issue than people described it as. I think the issue became executive compensation, not compensation. But and that got everybody interested.
Do you think this public outreach initiative, was that unprecedented in the history of the FASB? Had they ever had to reach out to the public on this?
Early on, in many respects, there wasn't any more public outcry over the answer than there was, for example, over pension accounting or certainly over oil and gas accounting years before I was here. Probably, though I'm not sure of this, over foreign currency accounting because they had issued Statement 8 and then reversed themselves to, well, reverse is an incorrect word, changed the answer dramatically in Statement 52. So there had been issues with significant public outcry and significant public outreach in terms of trying to reach a mutual understanding of what really improved financial reporting.
Was there a coordinated media strategy, or did you all try to work in an organized way to sell the message, or to sell the plan, I guess?
Well, I'm not going to admit that we were disorganized.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So, yes, there was a coordinated strategy of sorts, but I don't think that we had the resources to keep up with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And the organization and the money to be spent in fighting it. One organization later on, when I was an IASB member at an IASB advisory council meeting, said that they had spent $75 or $90 million fighting the FASB and were prepared to spend it again. So, you know, obviously the FASB didn't have those kinds of resources.
Did you go out and speak in public about the proposal?
Constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly.
Any happy memories from that time?
Very few happy memories. A few interesting encounters, yes, but not very many happy memories.
I read one report in an Oregon newspaper that said that in 1994 you had been heckled by an audience at a presentation there.
Yeah, that's true.
People were very angry.
Heckled might be a mild term, but in all fairness, to both the audience and to me, That meeting that I believe it refers to was instigated by Senator Wyden, who at the time was very involved with accounting issues because of his committee assignments in Congress or in Senate. And Senator Wyden asked that I come out and speak with a bunch of his constituents that he arranged. And he certainly tried very hard to run the session as though it was trying to be mutually educational.
Was he supportive of the FASB's efforts?
He was silent about that. I think in answer, I suspect that Senator Wyden was, because he always seemed very strongly interested in improving financial reporting, and I doubt that he would think that zero compensation was the right answer. But, of course, he had a lot of constituents that thought that is exactly the right answer. But I think he was very fair about the way I was treated and the way he treated the board, unlike some other senators who were not particularly fair about it.
So you had to do a lot of outreach to Congress as well on this issue?
A lot of outreach to Congress, a lot of outreach to constituent groups, yes, sir.
Okay. And then eventually over the course of 1994, the board finally decided to abandon the exposure draft as it was currently stated.
Yes.
Did that cause any discontent within the board itself, or was there any opposition to that?
Well, certainly there's opposition from Neil Foster and I. We dissented to that. So, Yes, we were opposed.
Right.
I've said before in other venues that I don't think anybody on the board changed their mind about the technical issue whatsoever. And I think they felt very threatened that Congress would, in fact, in a sense, blow up the board in private sector standard setting. And in their minds, it was a trade-off between perpetuating that or this issue. Neil and I thought that if every time the issue just got hot enough, we were going to back down, we didn't serve a significant purpose anyway. So that we might better stand and fight. In my personal opinion, this was an easier issue to fight than some others, because surely zero was not the right answer for what the compensation expense was. And it was easily understood. But remember what I said about the amount of money being spent in opposition. FSB didn't have those kinds of resources. So I think collectively the board may well have been right. Neil and I are certainly right over the technical issue, I think, and right that caving into political pressure wasn't the right way to set accounting standards. But they may have, there's no point in arguing it now. It happened. And
there were even some calls from Congress for legislation that basically would have put the FASB out of existence.
The Senate voted like 92-8 or something.
Yeah.
That in a sense of the Senate resolution that we were wrong. You know, that
was there any discussion within the FASB of, well, if we go forward with this issue, is it going to pose a threat to our existence as a private sector standard setter?
Sure. I think that's much of the reason why the five others decided to switch to a disclosure only rather than a recognition and measurement standard.
Of course, eventually the FASB did issue a statement on stock options, but two of the board members, including yourself, refused to endorse that standard.
Well, it was disclosure only, not recognition and measurement, which is why Neil and I dissented.
In the text of the standard, it spells out the reasons for the dissent in pretty frank terms, and basically referring to the political environment. Is that typical for a standard to have that kind of language in it?
Well, it's not in the standard, the language. The language is in the alternative view or the dissent.
Right.
And the dissenters have a right to say what they want to say as long as they're accurate about what they're saying. And, yes, there have been times that the language has been somewhat harsh by dissenters, although usually perhaps that one was more direct to the politics than most of the others. But,
okay.
But not an unusual dissent, no.
Right. All right, well, I think we covered stock options pretty well there. What about derivative instruments and hedging activities? In 1998, the FASB issued a statement on derivatives. Do you remember what this required?
Sure, I remember what it required in excruciating detail, I'm afraid. And it was problematic as well. Politically, people didn't like that one either. It was... And it's not a model of the way standards necessarily should read, because it starts with the notion of a definition of derivative, said derivative should be at fair value, and then goes on and makes enough exceptions to that that it is mind-numbingly complex to know whether you're in compliance. Mm-hmm. And the standard, the FASB, has made proposals more recently to simplify that fairly dramatically, and I think still is a high priority of them to do that. But the alternative for almost all derivatives is not account for them at all other than on a cash basis, because there is no historical cost of most derivatives, certainly a premium paid for options. Mm-hmm. You can have prepaid forwards and the like, but for all practical purposes, you either account for them at fair value or you don't account for them at all. Mm-hmm. And so the question is really was, how broad's the definition of derivative? And that's where the exceptions and much of the complexity came in. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, the other complexity comes in the measurement, because we measured those derivatives and had to measure and made the derivative to qualify for hedge accounting, which allowed you to mark the hedged item to market as well as you were the derivative for a fair value hedge. Any ineffectiveness had to be measured, because you weren't allowed hedge accounting if the derivative instrument's not an effective offset. Mm-hmm. Therein lies a lot of the complication as well.
Yeah, many judgments to make in that regard. Why do you think it was possible to issue this standard and not the stocks options standard? I mean, they were both very politically difficult.
I think it was just the attitude of the board. Mm-hmm. At the time, over stock options, the board made a decision, as I suggested, perhaps an expeditious one in terms of resources and the like, or threatened existence, although I would tell you that I thought the existence was far more threatened over derivatives than it was over stock options.
Why would you say that?
Well, first place, the legislation got farther in Congress, and there was more congressional interest, and it was much more difficult to describe to people why it was important to account for those derivatives than stock options. The man on the street sort of knows that if you're granted a million stock options, you probably got something. Mm-hmm. You know, and why wouldn't that be compensation?
Whereas he might have more trouble with
but the derivatives, far more difficult to try and convince people and explain to people that are, unaware of some of the nuances of the derivative issue. It was a very difficult time, but the board and then Chairman Jenkins felt very strongly that the question of accounting for derivatives was imperative.
Mm-hmm. And in 1996, the FASB also decided to open up the issue of business combinations, which had been a very controversial issue back in the 1970s.
Yep.
So clearly you weren't shying away from difficult issues.
No, I don't think the board can be described as having shied away from them, though they don't shy away from putting difficult things on the agenda. They may shy away from the optimal answer at times in the deliberations, and sometimes that can be called a practical expedient, sometimes not. But no, I don't think they've shied away. And again, business combinations was extraordinarily controversial at the time. But again, not difficult to think about in terms of, in a sense, why should you just structure the deal with a few little tweaks and get a completely disparate accounting result? And by the way, most things that you pay $1 million for, in our model, you record at least initially at $1 million and not give up $1 million worth of payment, $1 million worth of stock, to record something perhaps at $100,000. It was anomalous accounting to do pooling of interest accounting, and I think more easily understood by people as being anomalous than what the derivatives issues were.
Okay, let's talk about some international issues at the FASB. When you joined as a research director in 1982, I believe, Were international issues something that the FASB was looking at all?
No. Not necessarily.
When do you recall it becoming a serious object of interest?
Well, it wasn't that they were ignored. It's that there wasn't any thought that we ought to contemporaneously debate any issue. There wasn't any thought that we necessarily ought to get to the right answer, the same answer. But remember that there's a huge 6-inch stack of standards in the United States and not internationally. And in fact, there was as much interaction at some times with the Canadian Standards Board or the UK Standards Board or the German Standard, whatever, particularly the UK and Canada, mm-hmm. as there was the old IASC. Yeah. Now, the old IASC dutifully came by, and we met with them like once a year. A representative, the chairman, would come by, and Don Kirk and I or a couple of board members would meet with them. But there wasn't huge interest. One board member had a significant interest at the time, Ralph Walters, from the FASB. And not that he wanted us to be derailed in any way to accommodate anything going on internationally. He just was very interested.
Mm-hmm. So in 1991, the FASB amended its mission statement to add an international objective. What had changed by then that made it so important?
Well, the ISC, the old ISC, asked us to go on an advisory group they had. And we didn't really choose to do that. I went to one meeting. It was totally ineffectual, in my opinion. But at the same time, it was becoming pretty obvious that the world's markets were becoming a far more integrated, and the extent to which accounting differences were significant was obvious to ask why. You know, why are they different? And so it was a slow process of recognition that, boy, we ought to get more involved internationally. And the result of us not being inclined to be on the IASC advisory group and fly all around the world for a one-day meeting and come home, we sort of said, no, we're not interested in doing that. Then the old IASC came to us and asked if we would mind or be willing to be at their board table with privilege of the floor but no vote. And we said, yes, we were willing to do that. And that really sort of got us on the track of being involved more with their issues as they were discussing them. And it showed us, in my opinion, because I was not the first person with that assignment. A different board member had it for like one board meeting or two of theirs. And then I got it and had it for 4 or 5 years.
What year was this when it began? You remember?
I guess it's got to have been about 91.
I'm sure there's a record.
Right around in there. And I started attending all of their meetings, and they were starting to go through things like that we were doing, income taxes, other things, you know, were on their agenda. So that there was much more commonality as to the kind of issues that either we had just gone through doing or were in the process of doing.
Had you had much exposure to other national systems?
Me, personally?
You personally?
None.
What about anyone else within the FASB, some of the research staff?
I don't know that research staff would have, but certainly some board members were senior technical people with major firms that would have had to have had a lot of international contact. But immersed in the technical issues, not so much. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then Denny Beresford became a chairman of the FASB in 87. Denny had been on the old ISC. So he had certainly knowledge of them, and he was one of the reasons he was willing to say yes to putting us on their, going to their meetings, mm-hmm. as encouraging. But we still, our plate was pretty darn full dealing with U.S. GAAP. We didn't need to worry that much about internationally. And it evolved over a period of time. And I'm jumping years, I know, but in that 90s period, it became clear that we had common issues. But who had the common issues were the Anglo-American countries. And the Brits and us and the Canadians and the Australians and the New Zealanders that formed the G4 plus one.
This was 1993. Tell me
and
about
that's
how that
93.
Came about.
And it came about essentially over some work that was done by myself and a staff person here named Todd Johnson with the UK. David Tweedy was chairman then of the Accounting Standards Board in the UK. And David and Todd and I and a couple others had some meetings on common issues because they were dealing with pension accounting. They were dealing with financial instruments, and not necessarily all that successfully. They were trying to develop a framework. And we got involved, and I got extensively involved, in the debates involving the UK framework.
That's a very interesting story to me. How did you get involved in debates?
Well, because David Tweedy asked me to.
Yep.
Okay. And a couple of the firms were taking them on with some of the most disingenuous arguments you'd ever heard. And I dueled with those firms through op-ed pieces in the Financial Times and elsewhere, together with Reed Story and Todd Johnson here. And it just taught us that the issues were common. And that instigated, why don't we try having some meetings between people with a common interest? Well, the G4 plus one was thought to be a real threat to the ISC, and they were not happy.
So they weren't. They didn't see it as something that could possibly.
They back up initially before. Were just wanted it to go away, and we said, "Well, you're more than welcome to participate in any meetings. We have absolutely nothing to hide." And frankly, a couple of the European countries were pounding the table that they ought to be able to be in the G4. And we said, fine. The only thing is we're not going to waste our time debating issues and discussing issues with someone who doesn't have the same conceptual framework. And a good many of you European countries disavow the IASC framework and the FASB conceptual framework. You don't believe financial reporting is for decision usefulness of information to outsiders. And we're not going to waste our time debating accounting standards around whether they suit the government policy goals of a given country. And by and large said, well, if we have to debate the issues in terms of the framework, we're not interested. So they didn't participate. So it became just the Anglo-American type countries.
Right.
Okay. I find it interesting that they call it Anglo-Saxon countries, since Saxons are Germans. So I didn't quite never understood that. But the Anglo-American countries found it useful. And I think some of the papers that the G4 plus one put out over its existence were pretty good. Now, they're easier to write a really good paper when there's no constituents complaining about the answer. But I think we taught each other a bunch of things in that process. That led to criticisms that the ISC was just not really up to the task of being truly an international standard setter. And frankly, the combination of, by then, Ed Jenkins and Mike Crouch, who was a board member here, and Tony Cope, who was a board member here, their efforts, and Tony had taken my job to be the observer to the ISC. Tony and Mike was on the ISC as a U.S. rep. Okay, those people with Ed Jenkins were instrumental in getting the ISB formed as the ISB is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you have to give the ISB an enormous, or the ISC an enormous amount of credit in the sense that they essentially disbanded. They knew their existence as the organization that was created was going to go away, and they instigated that,
mm-hmm.
which is to their credit.
So the initiative for the IASB came from within the IASC?
Absolutely. Now, there was pressures from the outside, but no, they stepped up and said, we're not functioning in a manner that's going to allow us to be considered a world standard setter.
Was the G4 plus 1 on board from the beginning? Did they think it was a great idea, or did it take some convincing?
The G4 plus 1 was supportive of the IASB organization, mm-hmm. absolutely, or reorganization, absolutely,
mm-hmm.
absolutely.
Okay. How important was the IOSCO in bringing this about? It's the International Organizations of Securities
Commissioners.
Ooh, yeah, because Security Commissioners.
IOSCO was, of course, important because, in a sense, if you're going to be an international standard setter, you've got to get security regulators' support for doing that,
right,
and the SEC as well. So, yes. And when I say a lot of credit goes to the individuals I mentioned, a lot of mm-hmm. credit goes to the ISC, the IFASB, and IOSCO,
mm-hmm.
and particularly the SEC. They were supportive of a reconstituted ISB.
Did the FASB have any interaction with IOSCO at all? Or?
Oh, sure. Sure, to some extent. Well, but almost always through the SEC, because the SEC has
right.
always been significant, obviously, in IOSCO activities.
Mm-hmm. So, during the mid-90s, the ISC came up with a plan to produce what it called a core set of global standards by 1998. Do you remember this plan?
The old ISC?
Yes.
Uh-huh. No, that was not, I remember it, but I don't remember details.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not when I was any longer the advisor,
right.
or the observer from the FASB. That would have been Tony Cope.
Okay.
So right. I don't know in detail, but I know that activity of trying to do that and make those robust standards is one of the reasons they concluded that they internally were not organized in a way that was going to be operational.
Okay. So in July 2000, you became the first director of international activities at the FASB. How did you go from being a board member to being back on the staff?
Well, that was a title that was dreamed up that sounded good at the time, I think, for
okay.
a while, because I'd done a lot of international activities. I'd been involved with G4 Plus One from its inception. But the real reason I stayed at the FASB was twofold. Some other activities and to chair the Derivatives Implementation Group.
Ah. Okay.
Because the derivative standard was out and effective, and it was just, I mean, enormous number of issues. And it was like a...
The derivative standard was in 1988, right?
Yeah. It's a focus group on
yeah, tell me about
derivatives.
The work of that group, because that group is quite important. And it's still in existence today, is it not?
Yes, but it doesn't have the same authority and activity that it had at one time. But at that time, it was like an EITF. Structure very similarly, all the firms represented and the rest. And we were trying to identify implementation issues. And rather than just have the staff here answer them one-off, issue by issue, we thought this is so pervasive that we need to have a public due process, something where the public can know what's going on, be aware of what conclusions are, participate in the debates.
Mm-hmm.
And so we formed that Derivatives Implementation Group. And I was the initial chairman of it, and we just weren't anywhere near done
mm-hmm.
with the issues we had. So Jenkins actually wanted me to stay on to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we weren't going to have me do just that. So we trumped up some other activities, and the title came out Director of International Activities. But that's also because we knew that the ISB was absolutely in its formative period. And I did a lot of the work from here with Mike Crouch and Tony Copes, because Mike Crouch took my place on the board. So Mike and Tony and Ed and I were the ones that had a lot to do then with the crystallization of what happens with the ISB.
So at that point, had you already thrown your hat in the ring for possible participation in the ISB?
I didn't throw my hat in the ring, per se, but I was asked once they actually got done and formed it if I was interested in being an ISB board member.
Mm-hmm.
And I said yes.
Okay, so you actually said yes the first time, this time.
Yes, I said yes the first time.
Okay.
Because I felt very strongly that once reorganized, they had an opportunity to really make some fundamental improvements in financial reporting.
Mm-hmm. Did they just ask you outright to join the board, or was there an interview process?
Oh, no. They have trustees that go through a very formal selection process, and then they announced all, I guess there were 15 board members or 13. I don't remember what the original was now, but they announced all of us at once.
Mm-hmm. And you had to relocate to London during that period?
No, I lived here.
Oh, you did? Okay.
But that's because the initial ISB was formed with five liaison board members. And their job with Australia, Japan, Canada, the United States, France, and Germany, I guess six, maybe seven, I don't know. No, but the one, Tokyo, Japan, Australia, here in Canada were the ones away from Europe, and we were assigned to spend half time with our domestic board, half time ISB. So my job was, the whole time I was there, was to spend half time here and half time there. So I didn't see any reason to move.
Did you feel like you were in any way a representative of the FASB, or were you just a liaison and communicating?
No, I was not representing the FASB's views, no, or vice versa. It was a matter of attempting to communicate so that we had a mutual understanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Soon after its formation, any organization has a lot of challenges. For instance, fundraising for an organization like this. Was funding for the ISB already guaranteed this time? Was that something you had to worry about at all, or did trustees take care of that?
You'd have to ask trustees about funding.
Right.
Board members pay no attention to that, other than cashing your paycheck.
Did you have to recruit any staff or do anything like that?
Oh, we were involved with staff recruitment and interviews, and certainly, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you all pulled in people from all over the world?
Yes, by and large, yes. And a lot of them came from national standard setters, either permanent assignments or secondments, so that we had a nucleus immediately. And, you know,
does it still work that way today?
There are still some of that today, although they have a much more significant, the ISB now has a significant permanent staff of their own, yes.
Okay, it was a new organization, so obviously there were a lot of new procedures to work out. And did you have a set idea in your mind of how your job would be?
Well, I sort of knew how I wanted it to be, and they were committed from day one to a very open due process, open meetings and the like, and quite honestly, the first one to look at was the FASB's procedures, and they did that studiously and did some things slightly differently, but by and large said if it was an acceptable process for the FASB, why wouldn't it be for us? And that was sort of a mindset. Once you're committed that you're going to have open meetings and not set things in closed meetings and the like, so...
The constituent groups of the ISB are obviously a little bit different from the FASB. How did the pressures of the job differ? I guess just in the sense, I'm mostly interested in the sense of how dealing with lots of different countries differs from...
It's actually amazing the extent to which in the due process of setting accounting standards, the issues are not terribly different from one country to the other. Now, a given country may have a particular issue they're most interested in for some particular reason, and that can be vexatious for them and for the board. But by and large, constituents from around the world, their comment letter process, their impact on issues, their analysis of issues, pretty darn similar. Now, the thing that's different about the ISB and was troublesome from day one is Europe and the European Commission. And the European Commission think that they have an opportunity, or still do, to dramatically influence the ISB. And in fact, when you set up a policy of saying you've adopted, when in fact you haven't adopted in up front, but have a process that's an extraordinarily cumbersome political process to endorse as standards are issued standard by standard, in a sense, makes the process so much more political than it needs be or needs to, or should be. And furthermore, in a sense, taught some of the constituents that participating with the ISB doesn't matter so much. Why don't we just go lobby the European Commission and see if we don't get our way there? And the attitudes are quite different. And in my opinion, not healthy at all. with respect to things. They put an enormous amount of pressure on the ISB, and I have tried to defend them that they're criticized all the time for all the pressure the European Commission puts on the ISB. You've read that in the press.
Absolutely.
And the like. And I say that's not fair. They can't help it that the European Commission chooses to do that. What you have to judge is what their response to that pressure is.
Right.
Unfortunately, it hasn't been satisfactorily at all times. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
Well, we'll definitely want to talk about that a little bit more later, and maybe in regard to some of the specific issues that that you all dealt with there. When you first started out at the IASB, how did you go about setting initial priorities? So
we had open meetings, set an agenda,
Right. Set
what we thought should be on the agenda,
mm-hmm.
and a good many of them were known. They were already on the ISC agenda,
right?
Or we already knew we didn't have, a standard on a given subject.
Mm-hmm.
But we also knew that the standards we inherited, the ISC standards, had a lot of purposeful ambiguity in them. They had contradictions even in them and internal inconsistencies. So the most significant effort in the first couple, 3 years was a massive cleanup of those older standards,
right.
Inherited standards. Some of the best work they've done has been doing that,
mm-hmm.
and they certainly improved them dramatically in that process.
Yep. Two of the big options big issues were stock options and business combinations.
Well, and business combinations was on because it was already on here, and we still had poolings in the international literature, and we knew that had to go,
mm-hmm.
or at least thought that it should.
Did the FASB and the IASB work together on that?
They did on BizCom 2. Mm-hmm. 141 was already
right. Done
here.
Uh-huh.
So 141 was done. And frankly, we put stock options on because some of us who didn't like the FASB answer wanted a superior answer and didn't believe that it was sustainable. And we hadn't. There was no standard whatsoever on stock options whatsoever internationally.
Okay.
So he said, well, put it on the agenda, and frankly, probably pushed the FASB into putting it back on their agenda earlier than they might have without ISB activity.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the political context of this time. This was when many of the big accounting scandals were starting to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So Enron hit really in the course of 2002. How did that impact the IASB's work?
Well, I don't think it impacted the IASB's work at all. I think mm-hmm. it impacted perceptions about the ISB, the FASB, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's had a not very desirable effect, in my opinion, that lingers, in that there's a real tension between what the ISB likes to call their principle-based approach, which I publicly said I have no idea what they mean by that, but I know what constituents mean, and I can tell from reading letters and conversations, and I know what some board members mean by when they say that. And what they mean is a standard that's not very rigorous, allows an awful lot of implicit alternative within it, because they say, well, we're just allowing judgment. But the parameters of the judgment are so wide that it's difficult to say that you've ended up with an accounting standard.
Right.
So, and Enron and the like caused the rest of the world to say, see, the U.S. way of more detailed, robust standards doesn't work. And because they're too easy to get around. Well, that's a vacuous statement. The people ignored the standards, and you can always engineer around a bright line. We understand that. But there's no point in trying to get around a standard so general that you can do whatever you want. If you can do whatever you want, you don't need to do any engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think the argument is forthright. I don't think it ever has been.
Oh.
And I think it's a detriment to convergence to this day.
There's a big debate, even in the United States, over whether things like Enron were caused by accounting standards. I mean, you could just as well say that it was an enforcement issue or a
Absolutely. Professional
standards issue.
Absolutely. Not an accounting standards issue, although unfortunately, the things that Enron ignored were not the best of the accounting standards in the United States. I think they obviously could be and should be improved, and have been, and have been in some respect in response to Enron. But I don't know whether it would have mattered what standard was in place. We were ignoring it anyway. So if they're going to, if someone sets out to say, I don't care what the standard is, I'm going to do what I want, and they can get away with that for a while, I don't think that's a standard-setting issue.
Just to switch back to national U.S. standards for a second, were you asked to offer any input into the process that led to Sarbanes-Oxley?
I personally was not involved in Sarbanes-Oxley, no. But both board chairmen at the time, Ed Jenkins and then Bob Hirsch, had significant involvement with particularly, I believe, Senator Sarbanes.
What did you think of the creation of the PCAOB?
I have no opinion on auditing anymore. I'm not qualified to answer auditing questions. I have nothing to do with it. I haven't audited anything in 28 years. I probably have nothing to add to that subject.
Okay, fair enough. Were you involved in the creation of the 2002... Were you involved in the creation of the 2002 Norwalk Agreement between the IASB and the FASB?
Sure. Both boards were.
Right.
Both boards were significantly involved in the agreement. Mm-hmm. Although more has been made of that agreement than I think is necessary because they've been working together anyway.
Right.
And to formalize that in a sense by saying, okay, here's the projects and let's work closer together and the rest was just almost an obvious small step.
Mm-hmm. But it sent a signal, though.
But it sent a signal and a perception, and that's why it was done. And, we were all in agreement about it. But as I said, I don't think it was controversial internally or even externally because people that had watched the process could see we'd been working together anyway.
Right. Whose idea was it to work on business combinations?
Business combinations? Well, I don't think that it was any debate within the IASB on day one to put BizCom on the agenda. And part of that is because of the anomalous pooling things. Plus, remember, the UK had kind of a different pooling thing, and there were differences over whether you did or didn't amortize goodwill,
right,
whether you charged it off immediately. So it was widely recognized as a major international issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then in October 2004, at a joint meeting, the FASB and the IASB decided to add to their agendas a joint project on creating a conceptual framework. What was the goal behind that project?
Well, we both had conceptual frameworks, obviously, and they are very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And that shouldn't be a surprise. The FASB framework was in place when the IASB framework was written. There are several frameworks around the world, and they all are very, very similar. But there are nuanced differences in words, and sometimes those words make more difference than you might think they would. And
can you give me an example of that?
Yeah. You go look at the definitions of assets and liabilities, and they're slightly different. And since that's fundamental, you got to make sure you have a common understanding of what you meant by that. And there are differences even in the words involving the objective of financial reporting, decision usefulness, qualitative characteristics of useful information. So we just decided to just take the two frameworks that are very similar and not start over, but say, okay, what do we agree around the objective of financial reporting, which is done now? What do we agree about qualitative characteristics of decision useful information, which is done now? They're in the process of defining the reporting entity, which curiously has never been in a framework, either framework. But where we have bogged out and where the real difficult issues were going to be and predictably would be was on recognition and measurement, and particularly the elements definitions and then measurement of them. And they worked very hard for about a year on that and then got trapped in the drive for June 30th, 2011 and different priorities and the frameworks put on back burner.
Mm-hmm.
My personal opinion that the project's still the most important one on the agenda. I don't know what will happen to it after June 30th, 2011. But I also know that the failure to address the framework has caused extraordinarily inconsistent answers that are forthcoming in some of the Memorandum of Understanding projects, and it has been extraordinarily inefficient as a standard-setting process because the same issues are debated over and over again. You debate liability measurement, you debate it four times because four projects all have a liability that needs to be measured. So we have the same debates. Mm-hmm. I sat through those ad nauseum at the ISB, and I think could have been alleviated with a different prioritization.
Mm-hmm. The first memorandum of understanding that you were talking about, I think, was in 2006. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that's the right way to go about achieving convergence to set memorandums of understanding and then work on each issue individually? Yeah. Is that the best way to do it?
Well, I think the 2006 decision was the right decision. Perhaps its implementation in hindsight has been suboptimal. But 2006 Memorandum of Understanding was instigated when Chairman Donaldson was at the SEC with Don Nicolaisen as the chief accountant. Mm-hmm. And the alternative to doing that is a differences approach. And you take a look and you say there's these 75 things, or maybe 575 things, are different between U.S. GAAP and ISB. So put all of those on the agenda and resolve them. Well, at first we were saying, well, obviously somebody's probably got a preferable answer. Let's adopt it. You know, but we had more difficulty identifying what was preferable than perhaps one might have thought. But more importantly, the leadership of the SEC, and then with the concurrence of the European Commission and others, said quit trying to reconcile all the differences. In fact, back up and say, what are the really major differences? What areas are significant, and what areas have very unsatisfactory literature, both in the United States and internationally? In other words, where are your problem areas? And you start down that list, and it's business combinations, pension accounting, derecognition, liabilities and equity, you know, and keep going.
How many of these issues have been dealt with?
Keep down the list. And those issues were identified as ones that, let's focus on those. Don't try and reconcile bad standards. Mm-hmm. Leases would be the poster child for that. Don't try and reconcile bad standards. Start over. And that process was instigated then. Now, I think what was wholly unrealistic is later on, and even then, suggesting that list of vexatious issues that had troubled people for 25 years were going to get resolved by June 30th, 2011. I think it's ludicrous to have reached that conclusion. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they reached it and reached it again later on by reaffirming it and tweaking around sort of the definition of what constitutes done. Mm-hmm. So that I think one of the ways you get done with things is change the definition of done. Mm-hmm. But as a practical matter, many of the issues on that original MOU are not done at all and haven't even been seriously worked on. They were attempted, but when answers weren't forthcoming between the two boards, they've been dropped to concentrate here in the last 18 months or so on revenue recognition, leases, which were two principal ones, the fair value project, which the ISB and FASB will get done, but remember that's because Statement 157 was already done in the United States. So that's really just minor improvements to 157, you know, and insurance accounting, which was not even on the MOU, but is a huge priority of the ISB. So RevRec, insurance accounting, and leases have been where all of the energies, almost, of the last year or two have been spent, plus our old-time favorite, financial instruments. And financial instruments, the activities of the ISB and the European Commission, I think, precluded the possibility that would be effectively done by June 30th, 2011.
Yeah, there's been a sort of tension between the ISB and the European Commission.
And the ISB and the FASB, because the ISB went ahead and issued at the demand, because of the demands of the European Commission, issued IFRS 9, and the Commission said it was essential it be done by a given date so that it could be adopted by a different date, and then they chose to not endorse it. so it couldn't be adopted anyway. But now there's been a line in the sand, if you will, and it demonstrates that the right thing was back in 2005 or 6, and that's to contemporaneously work on the issues. Mm-hmm. And where they get in trouble is where one board moves ahead of the other. Because no matter which one that is, once one board's resolved an issue in their mind, the other board looks at it, they're either compelled to get that same answer, which they might not be inclined to do. In fact, maybe have even learned that answer the other board probably wouldn't like either. Mm-hmm. So then there's, as the boards call it, a leapfrogging approach, mm-hmm. where one, you never get done.
Right.
And I think clearly the right answer was what we started out to do, which is identify the major issues, contemporaneously debate them, mm-hmm. and resolve them. But the pace of getting that done didn't satisfy certain groups for reasons that, in some respects, I don't understand, mm-hmm. because their alternative isn't going to get done either.
Right. So now that you've delivered a very effective critique of deadlines and people's willingness to stick to them, I'm a little hesitant to ask you my next question, which is whether you'd care to wager a guess as to what date we'll be able to declare convergence between American and international standards.
I don't know, because I think a lot of that depends on what happens politically. One scenario could be never, and another scenario could be in some number of years. Mm-hmm. But the pressures to do anything at the ISB will be dramatically reduced if the SEC allows IFRS standards, mm-hmm. In the United States for U.S. registrants.
So you think that's going to be the key?
Then everyone says, oh, well, we're happy. The world and certain companies here will say, we're happy. Don't do anything anymore.
Okay.
Now, that will be a disaster in terms of those who want to improve financial reporting and look at the list that was on that MOU. And remember that's because it was judged that the U.S. accounting was deficient as well as international. And those improvements are yet to be made.
Right. Okay, let's talk briefly about the last year. You left the IASB in June 2010. What made you decide it's time to leave?
My terms were up.
Well, that's a pretty good reason.
Yes, I had no more terms to serve, so it was easy.
And you found a place back here at the FASB?
Bob Herz and Russ Golden was then the director of the staff here. Both asked me to stay here, in part because this convergence process was still going on, and obviously I had a lot of ISB familiarity, mm-hmm. and a lot of FASB familiarity as well. Mm-hmm. And I said yes. I like working on the technical issues, and that's what I've been doing. Well, is working on almost exclusively technical issues. Plus, they have been under such an extraordinary meeting schedule that the ability for board members to do the thing, board members of the FASB, to do the things that they themselves would like to be doing, mm-hmm. such as an awful lot of public speaking and the rest, they just don't have the ability to do that. So I've been doing a bunch of that for them as well.
Okay.
So that's, it's so far been a 9 or 10 month experiment so far, but working out all right, I think.
Good to hear, yeah. All right, let's just wrap up with a final couple of questions. I just wanted to ask you about the relations between the FASB and the SEC, based on your broad experience. Do you think they work well together?
I think the SEC and the FASB have always worked well together. There mm-hmm. have been episodic tensions, points in time where they could have worked differently than they did, but I think they've been a commendable relationship between the two.
Mm-hmm. How much difference do you think that it makes to who is commissioner of the SEC and who is the chief accountant? How much difference do personalities make?
Well, personalities can make that relationship work easier or less easy.
Yeah.
I don't think there's probably any doubt about that, except that overall they have a mutual interest in having the relationship be a sound one.
Mm-hmm.
And though there might be, as I said, episodic tensions over some issues, mm-hmm. I think the bigger picture almost always prevails, and people decide, hey, wait a minute, mm-hmm. we have to have this work out.
Right.
So, and I don't see how that changes, frankly.
Okay. Well, are there any final thoughts looking back on your long career in accounting?
No.
Yep. Okay, great. Jim Eisenring, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.